All right, well, thanks to the organizers for giving me this opportunity to speak. And so I'm very glad to be here, and I had a very, very nice time, very nice 3 weeks here. So I'm going to talk about some work which I did with lots of people who used to be or are still in Munich at some point, but many of them moved on to other nice places, like Matthias is now visiting here as well. And so the connection of this talk to the theme of the workshop is that I'm also going to talk about quantum critical systems, and so I think it fits quite well with the topic of the focus week. All right, so let me give you a few words of motivation. So they just asked, so who is a condensed matter person? Okay. All right, okay. Anyway, so I'm going to talk about gauge gravity duality, and so obviously this provides new talks for strongly coupled systems. And then on the other hand, we have condensed matter physics, which asks many timely and interesting questions. And then of course the big question is, how may the two be joined together? And of course this is a non-trivial question. And so, okay, I think towards the end of the talk I would like to come back, and maybe using the examples which I'm going to discuss, we can discuss this a little further. And so, as I just mentioned, I will present some examples which may have to say a few things about this question. Okay, so these examples include the following. So I'll show you some new holographic quantum critical points. I'm going to talk about holographic P waves, superfluids, and superconductors. I'm also going to discuss some interesting pneumatic phase, which means that there's a condensate which breaks rotational symmetry, and that leads to some interesting physics. And in this context, I'm also going to find the so-called flexoelectric effect, which means that some strain causes polarization. So these are the topics which I'd like to discuss.
That's interesting.
No, it's not this. Okay, I'm going to come to this. Sorry. At the end, it's a
strain, not stress.
Yes, it's this kind of another contribution to the same equation. So it's related, but it's not the same. Yeah. Okay. So one topic which I'm going to focus on quite a bit is this called imbalanced mixtures. So somebody pointed out it should be unbalanced mixtures, but this is not really my invention. So I took this from some paper, so I took it for granted that it was grammatically correct. So what this means that we have a system which contains a different number of spin-up and spin-down particles. And so then people in condensed matter ask the question, how does an imbalance in the numbers, so a spin polarization, affect the superfluid phase transition? And of course that's an important question. And so there was this very nice investigation on superfluidity and imbalance mixtures. So in this paper, it's called imbalance mixtures.
Can they do this by turning on background B field, or is there some more subtle way?
Don't let me give away the punchline, but here or in my system. Or.
So obviously, quantum hall, you have spin polarization because there's a big B field. Are there other ways of getting it?
Well, no, here it's. Okay, let me. So they're looking at some ultra cold atom gas. And so it's lithium, and so they look at the hyperfine structure.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so they have spin up, and they can prepare spin up and spin down particles in the trap and have them in different numbers.
And they take a long time to flip.
But it's not actually a spin. It's just a
two-state
system.
I see. Fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in this phase diagram, you see the temperature and you see the spin polarization down here. So I'm just going to take this as a difference in the density between spin up and spin down particles. And they find this phase diagram, as you can see. So there's a normal phase here. There's a superfluid phase here. And there's a second order phase transition here. And then here, there's a quantum critical point. And there's this unstable region here, and this here down here, they find a first order phase transition. So it's second order, first order. And so this, of course, I mean, this I think settles some issues in about this pairing question and these imbalanced mixtures. But of course, it's a generic phase diagram in condensed matter. And I mean, there were many other people studying superfluidity with similar phase diagrams. So I didn't put all the references, but also, as you compared to Gil Ronzerich talks yesterday, so there were quite a few phase diagrams also in the contents of ferromagnets, which have a very similar structure. And they also included these pneumatic phases, which I liked very much for reasons that you're going to see in a while. Anyway, so this is an interesting phase diagram. And so now what is even more interesting, that if you look at QCD with a finite isospin chemical potential, so this is now in high energy physics, some people did some calculation using effective field theory methods, and basically they get the same phase diagram. So again, here's the temperature, and here now this direction is given by the baryon chemical potential, which essentially also tells you the difference between U and U bar quarks, if you want. So this axis, apart from going from the canonical to the grand canonical ensemble, is basically the same. And there's no condensate, and in this phase there's a pion condensate. And here again, here they see a second order phase transition, and down here they see a first order phase transition. So it's very interesting that these are two very different physical situations lead to this very similar phase diagram. And so here, I just put the pictures next to each other. And obviously there seems to be something universal about the structure, which is rather interesting because this is just what holography is good at describing universal features.
Sorry, yeah. Just around late. Could you remind just briefly what are the two phases on the right hand?
So this is QCD. This is cold atoms. This is QCD.
Yeah.
And in the QCD here we have no condensate, and here there's a pion condensate. So it's QCD at finite isospin chemical potential. I don't think this has been measured in any experiment. It's just a theoretical calculation.
Okay.
What's the unstable phase in the lower part of the left phase diagram? What do you mean by unstable?
So I think they see a mixture of space bubbles with different polarizations. Anyway, so we have this diagram from cold atom physics with second and first order. This is QCD with second and first order. So the question was, can we find this phase diagram in AES CFT?
Question. Yeah. Just on the side, it's probably not important too much, but this diagram is not resembling the QCD phase diagram in all regions. Like, it should break down at one or the other end. I don't remember which one, but.
Okay, so this is, I mean, it's a theoretical calculation at finite isospin density or baryon chemical, finite isospin chemical potential. So I don't think this has been measured in the real world.
I know you're arguing, but I remember that there's some recent paper that argues that this phase diagram is
okay.
Yamamoto and Damson, they.
All right. Okay, so let's take a look. Anyway, I'm going to say more things about such phase diagrams. Okay, so there appears to be some universal behavior, and can we describe imbalanced mixtures in gauge gravity duality? And so the answer is yes, exclamation mark. So I'm going to say to you why I say yes, exclamation mark. And then I can also ask, can we obtain a similar phase diagram? And the answer is yes, we can in principle. So, and there will be an interesting difference, but I think this will be it generates a lot of new questions, and there's things to be learned. And with these things to be learned, we can maybe later go back to this question. So, okay, so there's a whole story, and this is the story I want to tell to you now. Okay. So how do we get these holographic imbalanced mixtures? And people who know what I do is no surprise. So we look at probe brains and gravity duality. And but this is just a starting point. I mean, later we are also going to take these models, which in John's talk were qualified as all natural, whereas these were called natural. So we started with these for the field theory side, and then we need to include a bug correction, and then we will go to the all natural models later. Okay, so since now some condensed matter people are here, I think I have to explain this a little bit. So what's probe brains engaged gravity duality? So we have additional structure on the gravity side. And the key feature, which is the additional information which you get, is that you know the Lagrangian explicitly in the dual field theory, which sometimes can be useful. And so I'll show you very briefly how to get a holographic superfluid fluid from these probe brains. And so the condensate will be explicitly known on the field theory side, since we know the Lagrangian explicitly. So we can really, we have our Lagrangian, and there's some, among others, some fermionic fields in the fundamental representation, and they can form a psi bar psi state, and this will be our condensate on the field theory side. Okay, to explain this, let me just give you a very brief reminder of holographic superfluids or superconductors. Which is, of course, mostly due to this paper, which is, I guess, one of the main reasons why we are all here now. And so the starting point of Sean and his collaborators was to look at a charge scalar in Einstein-Maxwell gravity, and they actually saw that the scalar condenses. And shortly afterwards, there was a P-wave superconductor, which really means that there's a current dual to a gauge field condensing. And to actually observe this, it's not sufficient just to look at the U1 gauge field on the gravity side, but in fact we need an SU2 Einstein-Young-Mills model, so there will be an SU2 gauge field on the gravity side. And so I just copied the Lagrangian and the action from Sean's paper and also from Steve Kupfer's paper. So this is the S-wave superconductor where there's this charge scalar here. And basically what's happening is there's a scalar operator dual to a scalar, which in the paper was called psi, which was condensing. And then in this paper by Kupfer and Fufu, which is a p-wave superconductor, that's the action they look at. So these are my examples for the all natural actions in Lagrangians. And so they have here this SU2 gauge field entering. And so there's a current, which is a space, so a vector in space, and so this is its isospin direction from this SU2 symmetry, which is dual to a gauge field component A1x, which is condensing. So with Matthias in Munich, we asked ourselves the question, well, can we also get these superconductors in a 10-dimensional framework, which then ensures that we actually know what the dual field theory is, and we solve some equations of motion which we obtain from the 10-dimensional supergravity action. And actually it's possible, although, so we go one dimension higher, we are in 3+1 dimension, and our field theory is relativistic, at least at the start, and so the dual field theory is explicitly known, and also we find a qualitative 10-dimensional string theory picture of condensation in terms of recombination of string probes. Okay, and so this is achieved in this context of so-called adding flavor to gauge gravity duality. So there is a nice review about this by Andy O'Bannon and Andrei Panashev, which was given here 3 weeks ago, I think. And so I recommend to look at this to understand better.
So it works only with P-wave?
So far, I'm going to show to you it works only for P-wave, but okay, I mean, I would certainly say it works best for P-wave, and so that's why I'm stick to the P-wave here. And then in addition, the P-wave gives a lot of extra nice structure, which I would like to investigate. But okay, so P-wave is very natural, because then we have this gauge field in our action, and this is condensing, so some component of the gauge field is condensing.
Or is it just because it has nodes on Fermi surface?
Yes, yes. Yeah, okay, so it's P-wave in the sense that it has nodes on the Fermi surface. Mm-hmm. But in addition, it breaks rotational invariance. So I think in condensed matter, a P-wave condensate just means that there are nodes on the Fermi surface, but it's still a scalar. But here, in addition, it's a vector. It breaks rotational invariance. So when ADS-CFT people say P-wave is a little more than just a P-wave in condensed matter physics, because because there's always this vector from the inside.
But, sorry, there's a paper by Matthias Wappler, collaborators, and we looked at it briefly as well.
Yeah.
The pions condense in the V5 as well.
Oh, okay.
And I'm not sure which condenses first if you include back reaction.
All right, okay.
But you can get an S wave out of this construction as well, or it's out of a similar construction.
So the symmetry is not really crucial. You could do with P.
I claim it's not crucial.
Yeah. D-waves are difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, let me go to the next transparency.
So. Well, it's an ITC.
wait, okay. Okay, so anyway, I just wanted to introduce the term adding flavor to gauge gravity duality, so something which was invented a few years ago in the context of applying IBS CFT to QCD-like theories, and so NX2-4 super young Mills has all fields in the adjoint representation of the gauge group. So if you want to study quarks, which are in the fundamental representation, you have to do this adding flavor. So adding flavor means adding quarks, and so you have to add brain probes on the gravity side, and so this gives you fundamental degrees of freedom in the dual field theory. So, and of course, what we're going to do now is that we will take these quarks as being examples for our electrons. In some sense, it's similar because the symmetry which we consider is just a global symmetry. But okay, so these quarks are going to be our toy model for electrons. And so this means that, if you remember, so ADS-CFT comes from D-brains, and now there will be some additional D-brains which are embedded into this 10-dimensional space. So there's a 5-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, but then there's an additional internal space, which in the simplest case is just a sphere. And then we put some brains in there, and we can also look at some deformed versions thereof. So if we deform the space, then we can introduce a finite temperature, confinement, interesting features. Okay, so let me show it to you this extremely quickly, because so on the next slide already, I think there will be a superconductor. So the original ADS-CFT correspondence comes from putting these three brains into a 10-dimensional space, which has 1 time and 9 space directions. It spans these directions. And now we're going to put this extra D7 brain, which is a hyperplane, which spans 1 time in 7 space directions. And here there's 2 directions in which we have to fix the position. Now, from this picture, you can very quickly read off the symmetry. So without putting the D7 brain, we have an SO6 symmetry in these directions, which is isomorphic to SU4, which is the symmetry group of NX2-4 super young Mills theory. But now if we put something in these directions here, then we only have an SO4 times SO2 symmetry in these directions. And this is isomorphic to this symmetry group. And then that's important because this will actually determine the structure of this theory which we are considering. So the cartoon is that we have a 5-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, and this blue object is now this additional hypersurface, this additional D7 brain, and it's going to wrap essentially all of the anti-de Sitter space, and then an S3 subspace of this S5. And this S3 can now fluctuate, so basically fluctuate in these directions. And so the point is that these fluctuations now can then be identified with the masses of mesons, which are psi-bar-psi bound states. Okay, so that's very crucial. So these are our mesons, so this is in the field theory side. So there's a fermion bilinear in the field theory side. Okay, so as we were just saying, on the gravity side, the fluctuations of this probe brain are described with a so-called Dirac-Bohn infeld action, which I have written here. And in general, this is sometimes not so easy to evaluate. And the key point is that the gauge field appears here naturally, so it's very natural to have these gauge field condensates. Here, of course, the metric involves the coordinates, and these coordinates will give some scalars, so you could also consider these scalars condensing. But as Sean was saying, it's very hard to do D-wave, because so there's no spin 2 field in addition to the metric here. Okay, and so this word probrain means that we don't look at how these new quarks affect the stuff which was already there previously. So this is neglecting the back reaction means we add something on top, but we don't see how this changes what was already there previously. Okay, so the key point is that with this approach that we know what the Lagrangian is on the dual field theory side, and basically it's the Lagrangian of any four super young list theory. And now we add some fermions and some scalars, which are in the fundamental representation of the group. And this I in our case will run from 1 to 2, because we're going to look at U and D quarks to get our isospin chemical potential. Okay, so the important point is now that we can look at these fluctuations, and they organize in representations of the symmetry group which we got on the previous page. And so both on the field theory and on the gravity side, we can construct our representations from the field theory fields and from the gravity fields, and they match. And this gives some interesting structure. And so basically there will be some mesons, and then of course excited mesons with higher order masses. And so this structure will show up shortly when I talk about the superconductor.
So I have a very naive question on your duality and holography. The field theory content is always known, or is it only on special case where you know?
Well, that's why we do this whole business. Okay. So if you look at the, if we could do the all natural models, which are these, then these are very simple and beautiful, and they give a lot of universal structure, but essentially you just know there is a scalar condensing, but you don't know exactly what's inside the scalar, and the same for this current here. Here you know it's a current condensing, but you know it's a conformal field theory, but you don't know exactly the field content of this conformal field theory.
I mean, sometimes you can derive these from consistent truncation, and then you always...
Yes, okay, sorry, okay, so sometimes you can obtain them from also from 10-dimensional supergravity, so which is an alternative approach to what I'm discussing here. So now, one of the two possibilities to actually find out what the field theory is to use this Born-Infeld approach. So as John explains, this is kind of natural from string theory, but nevertheless, the calculations become more involved. But then in the end, you can write this Lagrangian, and then you know. And so here, at least in this example, we have a very simple field theory. So this is kind of the Ising model of ADS-CFT people, any support theory, and we just add some degrees of freedom. Okay.
In many cases, you don't know how to solve the field theory. That's why you need
to... Yes, okay, but at least it gives you some feeling that you know what you are talking about. Okay. And it's right, I mean, this is the Lagrangian at weak coupling, and of course, ADS-CFT should tell us something about strong coupling. I totally agree with that. But sometimes you can compare in some special situations. Okay, now to get to the superconductors, we need finite temperature, and we need a finite isospin chemical potential. So the finite temperature we obtain from putting this D7 rain probe in the black hole background, so not just ADS, but the black hole background. And this isospin chemical potential, which we need to compare with these imbalanced mixtures, is to consider a probe of two coincident D7 brains. So if we put not just one D7 brain, but we put two on top of each other, then there will be an internal SU2 symmetry, essentially. And this allows us to introduce U and D quarks, okay, which will be essential to see a condensate. If we just have one, we won't see a superconductor because the condensate will not be charged under the symmetry. So we need to do this extra complication to actually get a charged object which can condense. Okay. And so if we put two of these D7 brains, then we have an additional symmetry, which is U2. And this splits into this isospin symmetry and the baryon symmetry. Now for each of these, I can turn on chemical potential for this one and for that one. Now, I start with just introducing a chemical potential for this symmetry, and in the next step, then in two transparencies, I'm also going to introduce a chemical potential for that. So if we do that, then we put in our graph background a SU2 gauge field, and we look at its temporal component, which will have a non-trivial profile. And so 3 is now the isospin index, so it's multiplied by the third Pauli matrix, okay? And so according to the standard rules of ADS-CFT, the boundary behavior tells you what the asymptotic behavior near the boundary tells you about the operators in your field theory, and the leading term will be the chemical potential, and the sub-leading term, so that's the horizon of the black hole, the radial coordinate, and this will be the density. Okay, so the sub-leading term gives you the density, the leading term gives you the chemical potential. And the key point is now that if you start with this ansatz, then you find by looking at the free energy that there's a new stable solution where in addition to this field, you also have to have this field, which is now a vector in space and it's perpendicular in isospin space. So it multiplies sigma 1 in the first Pauli matrix. And here there is no constant term. So it's really it corresponds to a spontaneous breaking of symmetry, this tells you. And this will be our condensate here, okay? So there will be a condensate J3, which is dual to this gauge field. And because we did this construction with the Dirac 1 infrared action, we know the field content. So this is the third gamma matrix. There's a D quark, a D bar quark, and then U quark. And then because we added also some bosons due to supersymmetry, there will also be some bosons in this condensate. But essentially, so this will be our bilinear, which corresponds to the Cooper pair, if you want. Okay. Okay, and then we can use all the methods which have been discussed during this workshop this week to calculate correlators from these fluctuations. Okay, and that's what we get. So here I plotted the frequency-dependent conductivity, and where this GR is the retarded Green function for a particular fluctuation. And so here you see the real part of the conductivity. Here you see a normalized frequency. And then, okay, so we go to from this is the highest temperature, and then red is at TC, orange, then you see a gap appearing here, and the brown curve is this one. Okay, so it's very nice because you see exactly what you expect from a superfluid or superconductor, so there's a gap here where no energy can be absorbed by the system. And then we see these peaks here. So first of all, the fact that there's a gap means no energy can be absorbed by the system. And so since we are talking about these mesons, this means we describe frictionless motion of our mesons through the plasma, which we are considering here.
These are P waves again?
These are P waves.
Sometimes the P waves don't have a sharp cap.
Yes, but in this case, okay, so I mean, it's not sharp in the beginning, but at low temperatures. So there's a Drudel peak here, of course, and then there's a carbon. Anyway, so this structure is also quite interesting, and it corresponds to the higher order fluctuations of the symmetry group, which was, I was alluding to. So we see we have these mesons in the system, and they have excited states with higher masses, and so these additional wiggles correspond to the higher masses of our mesons. Okay, so now before I move on, let me include an aside. Well, so I showed this scenario to Joe Bashin here at this workshop, and he said that it reminded him of something in condensed matter. So, and then of course I was very enthusiastic about this, and I thought I should tell you about it as well. Okay, so this is a group in Oxford, and which has studied quantum criticality in an icing chain in one dimension, and so there's some work by Domolodchikov already some time back in conformal field theory, where he studied this one-dimensional icing chain where a strong perpendicular magnetic field is applied. And he was shown using these conformal field theory techniques that there's an emergent E8 symmetry. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to get hold of this paper while I was here, so I can't tell you exactly how this happens, but I thought it was very interesting. And now this group in Oxford, they actually saw this in an experiment. So here's the phase diagram, so that's from their paper. And so there's this magnetic field, and there's a transition between an ordered and a paramagnetic phase. And there's this quantum critical region here. And so Domolodchikov predicted that there will be exactly, so the word meson is also in his paper, so he also has this bound state, and due to the E8 symmetry, and there will be eight meson masses. And then for some reasons which I haven't checked yet, for the only the first two ones should appear in the spectrum, and the other ones will disappear in the continuum. So Joe Vachin told me about this, so if you want to know more, you should ask him. Anyway, so these people really see these two spectra, and as Somolodchik has predicted, the ratio of the masses is just the golden ratio, which comes from the EA symmetry, and so they can measure this in the system. Now, of course, this is beautiful and wonderful, and but of course it's very much related to the fact that it's a 1+1 dimensional system. And okay, so here the situation, of course, is much more complicated, but a few things are a little similar. So we see these peaks, which come from the representation of our SU2 times SU2 times U1 symmetry group. And so here, everything, I think, should be equidistant, except that the temperature and the density is going to blur a little bit. And so it's very nice that we can see such a structure also in a higher dimensional model. Now, of course, I have no idea how to realize this experimentally, the symmetry. I mean, here, I mean, an icing chain, okay, in some sense, it's a lot simpler than NX24 plus other hypermultiplet. But nevertheless, I thought it was interesting that such species are possible in context of quantum particle systems. And okay, so maybe the take-home message then from this is that at least these symmetry structures are also present in higher dimensions. And so you can really see meson excitations, and because we use the Strobel approach, we really know that this is, we know what the field theory is for these excitations. Okay, so this was my aside. Another very brief remark I wanted to make is that we can also study fermions, very similar to what John was saying, except that now we use this Probrand action to study the fermionic fluctuations. I put here D7 to make things simple, but really it's a D5 brain, which we consider for some technical reasons. So here we see the Brian zone, and so of course we don't have a lattice, so this is at TC. Our Fermi surface is just a free Fermi surface. And then if we lower the temperature, we just see the peaks exactly where the nodes are. Okay, so we have this P wave superconductor, and so the gap has nodes on the normal state Fermi surface, and that's just where we see the excitations. There's also this peak in the middle, which comes from the fact that we also have neutral fermions, which are maybe a little unnatural from the point of view of finite matter physics, but in this model, they're definitely there. Okay, so again, here now we know what the dual operators are, and there's the so-called mesinos, so they are the super partners of the mesons. They are bound states of a scalar and a fermion. So, and again, you can use the symmetries to construct all these operators and write down what their field quantum is, which is quite nice.
Sorry,
yeah.
Just hold on. What is this probe R?
Okay, this is the spectral function, sorry. Yeah, so this is kx and ky, and this is the spectral function of these particular fermionic operators.
Okay. In the spectral function, it's a imaginary part of a Green function?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Okay, so but now I want to come to these imbalanced mixtures, which I was discussing. And so for this, we turn on both an isospin and a baryon chemical potential. So that's the key feature. So for both this SU2 isospin and the U1 baryon, we put the chemical potential. And of course, you remember that our condensate was this rho meson consisting of a D bar and a U quark. And if we increase this baryon chemical potential for this symmetry, this turns U into U bar quarks, and then there's less U quarks which can pair in this way. So it's very similar to the cold atom case. We had spin up and spin down, and then if we turn one of them around, then there's less pairing possible. And here it's very similar, except there's this additional structure of the isospin. Okay, so now we investigated various possibilities, and again, we started with our Dirac-Bohn infeld model because that's where we know, from the Dirac-Bohn infeld model, we know that we have this field theory operator. And so we have really this interpretation of the spin up and spin down particles. And so that's what we get in this case. Okay, so because we have conformal symmetry, the scales have to be normalized to some external scale. So here's the temperature normalized in the isospin chemical potential, and the baryon chemical potential normalized with respect to the isospin chemical potential. And indeed, so we have a phase where there's no superconductivity, and there's a phase with superconductivity. And it's second order all along. So this is a second order phase transition. And here we have this quantum critical point. OK, and this phase transition is second order everywhere. Now, of course, at the beginning, I said we wanted to have a first order phase transition somewhere to get a match with this phase diagram, which I was discussing. And this turns out that you can't get this in this probe brain approach, because if you neglect the back reaction, you neglect just those interactions which will give you this first order phase transition. So for that reason, okay, so this is just the quasi-normal modes moving through the point. So we move through this point, and so here we have the super. This is the complex frequency plane. So here are the unstable and the stable mode, and then they join, and then they split again on the real axis. So this is moving through this diagram like this. So as Christian pointed out to us, of course, in this case, there's no ADS2 in the metric because it's just the probe brain. However, the equations of motion for the scalar, for the operator which drives the system into this critical point, the equations of motion look as if there was an ADS2 space. And that the dimension of this operator is independent of the baryon chemical potential. And this means that the Breiten-Monod-Friedmann bound is violated somewhere along the flow, but not in the infrared. And that's the reason why we don't see any further structure than this, just this. Okay. Okay, so now to actually.
Johan, sorry, the modes really do this at the transition?
Yes.
On the real axis?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just a numerical observation. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if we want to see a first order phase transition, we have to include the back reaction, but that's really horrible to do in this non-abelian DBI approach. So we go back to the old natural models, and we take our intuition that we have a rho meson with us from the probe brain case. So we look at this model, which is very similar to the one studied by Gupta and Pufo, and there's this parameter alpha, which basically counts the number of charged degrees of freedom over all degrees of freedom, which gives you a measure for the back reaction. So in addition to the Gupta-Pufu paper, we now include the back reaction of these gauge fields on the gravity. And so but in presence of this chemical potential, we see the same condensation process as before. OK, and what is very nice is that the phase transition actually becomes first over order above some critical value of this coefficient. So here's the temperature, and here's our superconducting condensate. And so at low values of alpha, we have the same as before. But then if we crank alpha beyond some critical value, we really get a first order phase transition, which is very nice. And so here we have the phase diagram. Here's the temperature. Here's this parameter alpha, which measures the back reaction. And so now indeed, we do get a structure where here we have a second order phase transition, and in this region it becomes first order. Okay, so now we're ready to finally get our imbalanced mixture phase diagram also in gauge gravity duality. And here I plotted it for three different values of alpha. So this is the smallest value of alpha, and then we go to higher and higher values of alpha. Alpha is this. It's the ratio of the gravitational coupling over the gauge. So it means it's a measure for the strength of the back reaction. So this is small back reaction, intermediate back reaction, and strong back reaction. Now, a small back reaction, we have a second order phase transition everywhere, which then runs into a BKT-like transition here at the critical point. And that's it's very similar to this PKT transition discussed again by Krista and collaborators in slightly different contexts. And here now the dimension of the fluctuation driving the system into this point depends on the baryon chemical potential. And so definitely there's an in the infrared, it's below the Brighton-Lohner-Friedmann norm. And there's an ADS2 space appearing as well. Now, if we crank up a little bit the back reaction, then we see a first order phase transition setting in here. It's still second order here, and again, there's this BKT-like transition there. And then if we crank up even further, then it becomes first order everywhere, and the BKT transition goes away. Okay, so now I come back to my second transparency where I said, can we get imbalanced mixtures? I said, yes, exclamation mark. I hope I convinced you. So we have this isospin and this baryon chemical potential. So we have definitely spin up and spin down particles, and we can tune their numbers. So that's why I can say, yes, exclamation mark. Now, then I answered the question, can we get the same phase diagram? I said, yes, in principle, dot, dot, dot. And now look at this phase diagram. So I will have to switch back a few transparencies. So there's a BKT transition here, it's second order here, and it's first order there. Okay. Now let's go back a lot of transparencies. And so what we see is it's just the other way around. Okay. So in our phase diagram, we have BKT here, second order here, and first order there. So it's the other way around than what these people see.
But there's a BKT
transition? No, it's first order down here. Okay, so, yeah, okay, I was oversimplifying, sorry. Yeah. Okay, the reason why it's so different is because we have conformal symmetry, and here they have, this is really, I mean, it's confining. And the fact that we have conformal symmetry, so here in this region of our phase diagram, there's conformal symmetry, there's a CFT, essentially from this ADS2. And here they don't have this because it's a confining theory. So, and this conformal symmetry which we have here actually forces us to have this BKT-like transition, and we have a second order phase transition down here. So my guess, which I came up when I was here to actually recover these diagrams, is that we have to break the conformal symmetry. I mean, at least this would give a chance to get it. Okay, I'm not 100% sure it's going to work, but I mean, if we manage to do this in a confining background, then maybe we get a chance to get this phase diagram. But nevertheless, I think the other phase diagrams, they're interesting in their own right, and it's an interesting model, and it has interesting properties, and there's an interesting phase condition, and for reasons which I can explain, it doesn't match the one which you see in the experiment, but okay, we can work on that, I think. Okay, good. So I have one slide about the BKT transition, which is really due to Krista and collaborators. So it's a BKT-like transition because it's more than two dimensions. And so the order parameters, so the reason it's called BKT-like transition is that as in a BKT transition, the order parameter scales in this way. And on the gravity side, there is this comes on the gravity side from the fact that the Brighton-Lohner-Friedmann bound is violated in the infrared, and so there's this ADS2 times this 2 region. One interesting thing is that this transition is only possible when the two parameters which are tuned have the same dimension. So in your case, it was a B field and a scalar, so this only works in 2 plus 1 dimensions. But here with this isospin and baryon chemical potential, this can work in any dimension because in any dimension they will have the same dimension. Okay, so I think this is.
Just one bubbling point. For the brains, it's not really ADS2 cross R2 like it is in the RN.
Yeah, that's true.
It's something
yeah.
weird. But.
Yeah, okay, sorry, I was a little sketchy. Yeah. Okay, so in for the brain case, the equation of motion for the scalar looks as if there were an ADS2.
That's right. Yeah. The transverse space is strange.
Yeah. That's right. Okay, so maybe just one short comment why there's this difference between the two models. So in one case, we see the BKT transition, and in the other case, we don't. It's a little surprising because, OK, in one case, there's the Buck reaction, in the other, there isn't. But nevertheless, I mean, the models are very similar. So what's the difference? As I said, so for the program model, the effective infrared mass of this field vanishes independently of the baryon density. And so the BF bound is violated along the flow, but not in the infrared. And here, so the interactions comes from the flavor fields, so the gauge fields on the brain, which directly interact with each other. Whereas in the Einstein-Young-Mills approach, so the old natural model, the effective infrared mass depends on this ratio. And the Breitenbrunner-Friedmann bound is violated in the infrared. And there is this ADS2 times S2 region. And here the interactions, so there's no direct interactions between the flavor fields, but they interact with the gluon field. And this gives an indirect interaction between the flavor fields again. I mean the gauge fields on the brain. OK.
What do you mean
by the gluon field? Sorry, this is I mix gravity and field theory text in one line, which is, I shouldn't do. The gluon is the color fields in NX24 supergluon theory. The flavor fields is the operators. Okay, sorry, it's not a very good indication. So it's interesting that this difference in the interaction creates a quite different behavior for this quantum critical point, which we can learn from this model, I think. All right. Okay, so now let me come for the last 10 minutes. I would like to tell you about something interesting, further interesting topic, which you can look at with these p-wave superconductors, which have the property that you have a vector condensing, so they break Lorentz symmetry. And actually, what we studied is we calculated this famous shear viscosity over entropy ratio in just the background which I've been describing to you in this talk. And so just a reminder, there's this very famous, I think one of the biggest successes of the ADS-CFT correspondence is this calculation of the shear viscosity over entropy density for a strongly coupled theory, where in dimensionless units, it gives this universal factor of 1 over 4 pi. So the units are h bar over k Boltzmann, and which is due essentially to these authors. And so they got this result by calculating the shear viscosity from the Kubo formula, which involves this West tensor two-point function. And heavy ion physics, this was a decisive step to show that ADS-CFT is relevant. And this is very, very important. And this is the smallest possibility which you can obtain by a calculation for this number, I would think, at least to leading order in N and the Tuft coupling. Okay. Some people included some higher order corrections, and they found a violation of this bound. However, this is, of course, subleading in 1 over square root lambda. OK, so these also provided a proof that this is a universal result. And the proof of this universality relies on the fact that the metric fluctuations are helicity 2 states. So this enters the proof at the decisive point. And so it's used in the proof. But here, of course, now, since we break rotation invariance because our condensate is a vector, we violate this prerequisite of this proof. Okay?
Well, what do you mean by that? In Gauss connectivity, it's the same equation, the model is just one parameter that changes. Why do you say that?
Sorry, I don't understand.
When you calculate this coefficient gauge in Gauss connectivity, you get something different. But still the same, it's the same equation, motion has different coefficients.
Yes, okay, but the effect is the effect is in 1 over square root lambda, where lambda is the Tuft coupling.
From the point of view of gravity, I mean, it satisfies this constraint, and there's just an equation of motion.
I thought the proof required Einstein gravity.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
Everything I'm going to say is only about Einstein gravity. And so only in the leading n and lambda terms. So it's leading in n, of course.
I'm saying I don't understand what's the meaning of Hellsic, of why Hellsic?
Okay.
Einstein,
yeah, Einstein. I talk about Einstein gravity, and in Einstein gravity, if you have, if all metric fluctuations are Hellsic to two states, then the proof tells you that you get this. If I don't talk about Einstein gravity, then I don't have to talk about this anymore, I think. Anyway, so now we have this p-wave superconductor which breaks rotation invariance. And so this means that the fluctuations of the metric and the gauge fields is now characterized by their transformation properties under the remaining unbroken SO2 symmetry. And so there are some helicity 2 states left, but then we get a bunch of helicity 1 and even helicity 0 states. And okay, so for the helicity 2 states, everything will stay the same as before. We get this 1 over 4 pi again. But here, actually, something else will happen, and this proof does no longer apply. OK, all these fluctuations couple to each other. And so it was quite difficult and a task to solve this. So I'm very grateful to Patrick and Hans-Jörg, who managed to disentangle all these equations and solve them numerically. OK, and so we see something rather interesting. So if here, this is the temperature, and this is 4 pi times eta over s. And so, there, of course, now if you do that, then the shear viscosity becomes a tensor. And some components of the tensor, which are not affected by this rotational breaking, they still give 1 over 4 pi, so they give the straight line. And the ones which are perpendicular now to the axis which you have introduced, they will actually now depend on t and on this parameter alpha, which is the gravitational coupling over the gauge coupling in the gravity theory. So this is the measure for the strength of the vacuum. So if alpha is small, we get again a second order phase transition here. And so here you see different values of alpha. You see different steepness of this behavior. Here the numerics breaks down, so we're not quite sure what happens if we take this to zero temperature, which probably would be interesting, but then we can't do the calculation right now. But if we go beyond this critical alpha where the phase transition becomes first order, then we see a first order transition here as well. Okay. Now,
the thing you're plotting in the vertical axis there is various components of this.
Yes. It's, so there's this component, which is 1 over 4 pi all the time. And then there's that component, which is now a helicity 1 state. And that will depend on the temperature.
Different colors or just different values?
They're different values of alpha.
What does it mean? It's not a function.
It's a first order phase transition.
Is only one of those is right?
No. It means this is for the smallest value of alpha, an intermediate value of alpha, and a big value of alpha. Okay. Alpha. So alpha is g, it's kappa over g. So I have this SU2 model, okay? So this is my gravitational coupling, that's the gauge coupling on the gravity side. So there's a critical value of alpha, which is 0.3 something, where the phase transition goes, so let's go back to this diagram. Where, so below this value of 0.3, I have second order phase transitions. So this is for different values of alpha each time. If I go beyond this value, my phase transition becomes first order. It becomes multivalued. OK, so here I see this is a plot of my condensate. Now I see the same structure here, the same values of alpha. So for the small values of alpha, I see that there's a second order phase transition. And for a big value of alpha, I see a first order phase transition. OK. Now, let's concentrate on these diagrams where the phase transition is second order. So if it's second order, we can analyze the critical behavior. And we can calculate the critical exponent of this object at this point. And what we find is this behavior where beta is equal to 1. And given that we are below this critical value of alpha being 0.3, we also see it's independent of alpha. Of course, if alpha is beyond the critical value, I can't calculate the critical exponents anymore because it's a first order phase transition. was this your question? Oh.
I just don't understand what the meaning of the rank plot is.
It's a first order phase transition.
Earlier I understood yeah. that they're plotting the various possible states,
yeah.
right? And you have to decide amongst them.
Well, but this is for three different models, if you want.
Fluctuations around a single state, right?
No, no, so it's these curves are for different models, parameterized by different values of this alpha.
I understand, I'm just asking about the one. Right?
Yeah.
So you're setting fluctuations around a particular state. Right? Mm-hmm. So there's just a definite answer for what the viscosity is, right? I don't know, depending on which side of the transition. I think I may be understanding some questions.
Okay, I mean.
So what's the red line?
This is just the value of this coefficient.
But how can it not be a function of temperature?
So the upper value and the lower value of fixed T are in two different phases.
Yeah, basically there's a jump.
One of them
yeah.
is unstable.
Yeah.
And so you should have just
yeah.
plotted, you could have just
yeah.
plotted the one in the stable
yes. okay.
phase. You have jumps discontinuously. To
yes, okay.
So you could have two colors on there to make
yeah.
it clear that they're
yeah.
yeah.
Okay, yeah, okay. Okay, it's a maybe a little simplistic plot. Anyway, let's concentrate on this diagram. So then there's, I can calculate this beta in this critical exponent and numerically found that is 1. Which okay, so there must be an analysis of critical systems with an anisotropic structure, but okay, I'm not really aware. I mean, so my students were very good. They started digging out all these papers from the 60s where people studied anisotropic hydrodynamics and later also anisotropic critical systems, but I think it's non-standard. But anyway, so this is rather interesting. I should say that 2 weeks ago there was a paper by Basu and O, and they actually did this calculation by expanding around this point analytically, and they really get this one directly analytically, which I think is quite interesting. Anyway, the main point about this is that we have this non-universal behavior at leading order in lambda and n. So this is different from the Gauss-Bonnet because it's leading order in lambda. And
what do you get just the mean theorem? What do you get if you just do mean theorem? Just break your rotation symmetry.
It's something else.
You get a different.
Yeah, theory. Yeah. Yeah, that's okay. So
I thought other there's this whole classification of dynamical critical exponents.
Yes, but these are not for anisotropic systems. I mean, then it must exist for anisotropic systems as well. Okay, so I know this is not mean fields, but okay, so it's not.
Mean field is there's many different mean field results probably for these critical.
Okay.
Guys.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Anyway, all I'm saying, we need to understand better what's happening on the field theory, but on the gravity side, it's clear that this is what must happen. Okay, so but, okay, so there's more things to find out. Yeah.
Another stupid question, related to the right.
Yeah.
There's some value of T over TC
yeah.
where if
it
you draw a straight line up,
yeah.
it would be tangent to that thing,
yeah.
which means if the phases separate, even though it's a first order transition, they actually have the same value. Isn't that a little surprising?
So, okay, so.
Well, I guess I'm saying when the second phase becomes to learn empathy
yeah.
before, it still has the same value of
right.
eta, whichever eta is you're plotting as the first phase, essentially, because of that tangency.
So wait, okay, so
why is that true? It's a first order transition.
So I mean, isn't there just a jump? I mean, it's just. I mean, you can just have a Maxwell construction if for this if you want.
Even jumps discontinuous.
Yeah.
So jump discontinuous.
Yeah.
The lower part is unstable, so it's
yeah.
really written. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I see that. That second red component is the.
Yeah. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Right, that's discontinuous. Okay. No, but then I'm confused by the plot again. So now there's certain points where you'll actually hit that three times in a fixed T.
Yeah, but it's a maximum construction. I mean, it's the same here. I mean, here you also
yeah,
have.
Do you have three phases? You have.
No. I mean, here's the same. I mean, it's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the disordered phase and two ordered.
Okay,
phases.
So yeah, exactly.
One ordered phase just never matters.
Yeah.
Oh, of course. Okay, you can't destroy her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I think it's not very different from this one.
Yeah, exactly. You can't destroy critical points. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Anyway, so. okay, so there's this non-universal behavior at the order number n. It becomes temperature dependent, but so the bound is not violated, so it's bigger than 1 over 4 pi consistently with this proof for Einstein gravity, okay, which is also reassuring. And then there's this interesting critical exponent. All right, and just to finish off, let me tell you about this flexoelectric effect, which, okay, so in pneumatic bristles, for instance, so a strain introduces spontaneous electrical polarization. And this is exactly what we see here in a slightly academic language. So because basically all the fluctuations couple to each other. So the stress fluctuations couple to the gate fluctuations. So a strain, so x is the direction of the condensate, and perp is the perpendicular directions. So if you have a strain of this form, this introduces an inhomogeneity in this current. And so 1 and plus minus are isospin indices. So and this introduces a perpendicular current, which you can kind of identify with your polarization. So basically, we see that a stress introduces a polarization.
Why doesn't second stress happen?
It happens because if you just look at the equations of motions for the fluctuations, and
why?
even in physics.
Yeah.
Okay. I think this is. I just present the result of the gravity calculation, and I say it's interesting. It's similar to this, and this is worth looking at further. And okay, that's why I said it's in a slightly academic framework. We just have lots of fluctuations. They all couple to each other. So if we switch on one, we get this other, we get a contribution to this current. And so then we, I mean, in a kind of crude first approximation of understanding the physics, we identify this current with the electrical polarization. Okay, so in pneumatic crystals, I think, I mean, what happens, I mean, if you have this strain, and so you have these polarized molecules which are next to each other, and if you put a strain, then it creates a polarization of the material.
You're actually saying that there's something like an off-diagonal Hall connectivity here between the
two. Yes. 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 Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, but okay. Okay, I'm just saying that's the result of the calculation, and there's promising, interesting physics, and we definitely study this more. And yeah.
Just allowed under as a consequence in the group, you have the SO2 that's left, and so you have some epsilon ij.
Okay, so there's another plot where I don't fully understand what happens, but it's just a calculation. So here you see the real part of the Green's function between the current and the stress tensor, which is zero in the probe limit. But here there's a contribution, and so at temperatures above the phase transition, this is the zero. And then if we go below the phase transition where the rotational symmetry is broken, we see these quasi-particles appearing. And again, we don't fully understand yet what this quasi-particle means, but it certainly reflects somehow this physical behavior. And this is certainly interesting to study further. Okay, so I should say in the directions which are parallel to the current, we see the thermoelectric effect, which you studied for the P wave, which is almost the same as the S wave thermoelectric effect, which you studied. It's just in these perpendicular directions you see this flexoelectric effect. Okay, so I think I can wrap up. So just to remind you briefly, so if we study these seven systems with finite isospin density, we get a holographic P-wave superconductor with known dual field theory. Then if we add the baryon chemical potential, we get these imbalanced mixtures of spin-up and spin-down particles, and so because we know what the dual field theory is, we can really describe the physics in this case. Then if we want to have first-order transitions, however, we have to go back to the Bach reactor systems, for which we use the bottom-up approach again. Then we see quantum critical points, which arise from an ADS2 structure in the infrared. And with the P-wave conductor, with the superconductor, with the spontaneously broken rotational symmetry, we get this anisotropy and the shear viscosity. We do find a non-universal contribution at leading order in n and lambda. And also, because of the coupling of all the fluctuations, we see this flexoelectric effect. So thank you very much.
This flexoelectric effect, yeah. It's due of what? An energy flux, it induces a current.
Yeah, so a strain, so, okay. So you're in this pneumatic phase, which means, so you have some molecules, which, and they have some momentum or electric polarization, say. Now, if you put a strain on the system and make them bend, then you introduce a polarization in a new direction. Mm-hmm. I think this is pretty important for liquid crystals, and there's some technological applications.
It's something that happens?
Yes, I mean, so, okay, I have to definitely study this more, but I looked a little bit on the web, and I mean, there's hundreds of papers about electricity.
This requires breaking time reversal invariance, right?
It breaks.
You have to break T and P.
I think we do, yeah. But in particular, for these pneumatic crystals, and this seems to be an important. Okay, I mean, so here, I mean, it's really here at the moment we just have a statement that introducing the strain causes polarization, which I think is also, but I mean, if you look at some particular crystal, of course, it has a lot more structure.
I'm just thinking.